to episode 73 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name's Robert, and I'm here with Scott. Scott, welcome to the podcast, and can you introduce us to our guest for today?
Sure. We got Nate Walroth. He's a brand manager at Tennis Point. So if you're familiar with Tennis Point and their social media, he's the guy that's behind that, I think. So, Nate, could you give us a little bit of your background and how you got into tennis, and then we can get into your job at Tennis Point?
Yeah, so I'll try not to hijack the whole episode, and I'll try to keep it short. But yeah, so I appreciate you guys having me on the podcast. I've known Scott now for a few years, running into him at numerous tournaments, Western and Southern, and some college events, and we connected pretty quickly, and it's just cool to see another person working in the game and trying to grow the tennis. It's that's kind of what got me in the door, and that's where I wanted to kind of start. And yeah, I took an internship 2000. I was a couple years out of college. I worked a couple real jobs, I call it, you know, trying to do sales and other things. And I came back home after living in Florida for a year after college, after my first real job, and got back into coaching tennis, got back into kind of playing more. And just, I was like trying to find what I wanted to do. And I took an internship with Midwest Sports back then. Basically just doing some blogging, helping out a little bit on Instagram. And then it kind of just went from one platform to the next. And yeah, I just kind of went from Instagram to Facebook to Twitter to TikTok. And kind of organically, I was just a contractor originally working on a bunch of other accounts as well, probably like six or seven other companies I was working with. But I definitely took a liking. I was spending a lot more hours working with the Midwest role than anything else. And it kind of just felt like a natural fit to eventually kind of go in all in full time. And now it's 4 years later, and now I'm full time and working in this in this more full time role for over 2 years now. So it's been a crazy ride.
Great. And so even before then, so what was your tennis background in terms of junior career, college, and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. Grew up in a tennis family. My dad played in college. I was at a swim club kid. I was always the kid that was, everybody else was taking swim lessons and playing basketball. And then we had our group. We actually had a really good group of probably like 40 to 50 kids from ages like 7 to 13 that were playing for hours a day. And I was playing on some Tenneco, not the red clay that you guys are watching now probably, but some of that green clay out there. And I played for hours all summer long. And I remember when I was about 10 years old, my parents saw that me and my sister were taking tennis seriously enough to join an indoor club. And I kind of just ran with it and ended up playing 4 years of high school tennis and then playing collegiate tennis at Bellarmine University, a place that my sister joined me as well there, and a place that we really loved and a city that we really have a lot of great times and experiences there. It was a great time of my life and spent 5 years there. I liked it so much. I had to do a fifth year lap. I was a sports marketing. I studied sports marketing and then business, and always been a big sports guy, whether it's basketball or tennis. And it was always my dream to work in sports. I just didn't really know exactly how to go about it. So it was kind of had to make a decision when I was working in, I coached basketball as well, and had looked at working in kind of ticket sales in the NBA, but definitely glad I pivoted and went to the tennis world.
Great. Yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, you sort of got into the social media game sort of on your own. So on your own, it sounded like. So I'm curious just how that works is, how do you go from, you know, you got to build, I guess, you know, a brand, you got to build, you know, a following or whatever to get you, you know, enough merit or enough, you know, recognition that, you know, Tennis Point or Midwest is going to say, hey, we want this guy to run that sort of. So maybe you talk a little bit about how you developed, you know, your marketing and your brand for yourself that led you to Tennis Point.
Yeah. So I will say, in college, I don't know if the word social media or brand awareness, either of those terms that I feel like I hear now, it's just everyday life is what I'm living, is like, those words were not mentioned to me before. I mean, marketing was like, I graduated in 17. So it was like still, I mean, social media was obviously a big deal back then, but people like in the business world were still huge on just kind of commercials was like a big marketing thing, and banner ads and traditional marketing, I'll call it, and more email, like obviously the emails was big. And, but yeah, as far as like the schooling part and like tennis, I mean, we really hadn't, I kind of had to learn on my own everything. I mean, whether it was making commercials or making graphics or making videos, promoting, whether it was equipment or kids or tournaments or events or new product launches, all those things. I kind of, the first 2 years I was an intern, I was basically an intern for, 2 years before we went and became Tennis Point. And it gave me a lot of time to experiment and try new things that I kind of saw fit in my own kind of vision. And I worked at I still work at a creative space downtown Cincinnati with a bunch of awesome creatives, a bunch of super talented guys that work in a bunch of different fields. Not just sports, but I mean film industry and everything else. And I mean, I was asking questions to these guys, people. I mean, there was 17-year-old, 18-year-old kids that were in there. And then there's guys that are my parents' age, and just trying to learn as much as I could every day, asking a bunch of questions and sitting in on meetings that didn't even have anything to do with what I was doing, but just to see what I could kind of what was working for in the other marketing worlds. And basically, I mean, yeah, you just kind of see what works and you check the numbers and the analytics and you see what people are liking, you see what people like and don't like, and you hope to get feedback from people, which is something that is kind of hard to come by. So I've always appreciated the friendships that people are critical of what I do, and I think that has always helped me as well. But I mean, yeah, I think it trial and error would be my number one way of learning. And then I mean, you got to tap into other markets, and you got to consume other content as well to see what you liked and what made you kind of take action on something. And I think that was something I was pretty good at, just because I do consume a lot of content, and I've always kind of ingratiated myself with whether it was just like the new and fun ways of promoting athletes. And I've always been very kind of perplexed and thought that was always very interesting to see how, like, whether it was March Madness or NBA or even like World Cup soccer. And just, I've tried to pick as many things as I could from those and try to kind of put those into our team. And I started off being kind of a one-man crew, and we've been able to add some teammates in the kind of creative department, which has really helped a lot. And it's kind of let us bring some more of our visions to fruition. So yeah, I think I'm talking a lot, but it's a complicated answer, because I think there's so many different parts of marketing. I mean, TikTok content is a lot different than commercial content. So you really have to kind of, one thing I'm not good at is delegating, but you have to try to put people in positions that you think that know how to do things better than you do. And that's something I've learned to kind of become better at, because you want to kind of be in control of everything, but you realize you can't spread yourself too thin.
All right. So you're talking about what works, what doesn't work, and kind of exploring that. Mm-hmm. Which of the platforms do you use that you think actually drive sales the best? Not necessarily the ones that drive views and clicks, mm-hmm. but the ones that actually translate into real sales.
I mean, the one that is easiest to track. Well, first off, I would say YouTube is one that I've become much more comfortable using, and as far as driving revenue and driving more long form content, as well as we now have affiliates that primarily use YouTube as their way of connecting with the audience. I would say YouTube is probably the number one sales driver for as far as content that goes, as far as organic content and as well as like bumper ads, really any ads that are on YouTube. And then second would be Instagram, and then third would be, I mean, so we do work with, I work with our ads team, but I'm more focused on the organic and just like the commercial type content. But I mean, the ads that go on Instagram and Facebook from like our SEO team, I mean, those definitely do well. But as far as organic, definitely YouTube and Instagram.
Gotcha. So do me a favor. Tell me, what is Tennis Point? You know, when you say, would you say you're the marketing director or brand manager of Tennis Point? What is Tennis Point?
Yeah, so Tennis Point, for those that are not familiar, is the largest online global retailer for all things tennis. So we sell, I mean, everything, rackets, string, shoes, hat, like all the apparel that you see the players at all levels wearing. We even sell pickleball stuff now. I mean, anything, everything you could ever want if you're getting involved with the sport of tennis, we have it. Ball machines, net cord. I mean, we sell nets. I mean, really everything.
Yeah. I would say, you know, Tennis Point is one of the top online seller of tennis stuff in the US, along with the Tennis Express and Tennis Warehouse would be the competitors.
And so we actually acquired Tennis Express probably about a year ago. So they're part of our team now. And yeah. So I've got a few, like our my team right now, it consists of probably four or five people in Houston with the TE team. Mm-hmm. And then as well as our team that's on Tennis Point in Cincinnati. So we still work independently as two different brands, but our teams are very much ingratiated and we definitely work together. We have a lot of meetings together, and just because Tennis Express has gained so much brand awareness, we do go after different, customers. We just did a big study where we thought we shared a lot more customers than we did. It's not, we actually do not share as much as we thought. So we definitely, even though we carry, I would say 75% of the same stuff, their marketing structure and just their, the people that consume their content and buy from them, it's different than the people that are coming to Tennis Point. So that's something that's pretty interesting, and that kind of alters our marketing campaigns for sure.
Yeah, well, definitely. As for me, you share me because I shop at both of you guys. So
that's all right then. We'll take it. We'll take it.
But yeah, so and you know, you said that you know Tennis Point acquired Midwest Sports a few years ago. I know that Midwest, you know, big there in Cincinnati, and so where is Tennis Point headquartered, and what does their global operation look like?
So we're headquartered. Our global headquarters are in Germany, which is where the company started. So that's why I remember the first time I saw Sasha Zverev, like after he won the Olympic gold. He won the Olympic gold, yeah, like 2020, correct? I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Yeah, he won the Olympic gold. Now I'm doubting myself, but he won the Olympic gold, then he came to Cincinnati right after that. When I realized he was, the Germans were familiar with us, that was, I kind of told me, like, this is pretty cool. Like, it's a global brand. When we were Midwest Sports, that was definitely more of a regional brand. But the global operation, they do things differently than we do just because their tennis culture is different than ours. So they're much more they have a advantage. It's called a coaches advantage program, where the coaches dictate a lot of what the players and the communities and tennis kind of use and wear. So I would say that like the club and the academy world in Europe is definitely a lot different than what we have here with clubs and camps and clinics and stuff. So we've tried to take on some of that with kind of having a teams program for whether it's women's four or five inner club or college teams that we've sponsored the ITA rankings. So we try to touch on the college market a lot more, and as well as the junior market. So I would say we're different, but we're the same brand, and we try to tell the same story. And our number one objective as far as me being on the team has been to grow the game of tennis and just to educate, inform, and promote and engage with the tennis community. So that's been the fun part for me.
Yeah. Like I say, I know that, you know, it looks like a really fun job. I mean, I've seen you, you know, at Western and Southern, but you've also had to travel to a lot of other tournaments as well. Talk a little bit about, you know, sort of where, you know, how that works in terms of, hey, we're going to send you to, you know, Indian Wells, and we want you to do this. So what does it look like when the schedule comes out and you see, okay, you know, we've got Masters 1000s here and there. Who decides who goes where? And then when you're there on the ground, what is your day like on a daily basis when you're at those tournaments?
Yeah. So, I mean, I dictate my schedule as far as where I feel like we can add value as well as get value in return, putting boots on the ground. So one thing I activated a couple of years ago is called our Team Yellow Tour. Something that I was very passionate about is I knew that like, there's not a ton of tennis companies that are putting people where tennis is played. And I wanted to be in the bunkers with these kids or adults or coaches or parents or tennis families. And I wanted to really, shake some hands and figure out how we can help them and promote them. So, I started off, we did a lot of junior tournaments. And then once we saw that was working, we went to I was pushing for us to join the college ranking system and trying to be a part of that world. And then we started doing more collegiate stuff. And I mean, obviously the Western and Southern is in our backyard. We have a store there. So I was going to that from day one, but we started adding the Masters 1000s and the US Open when this past couple of years, especially it makes sense with the US Open now that we have a store on the Flushing Meadows campus. But yeah, I mean, I usually try to get to 4 to 5 pro events per year, all three of the Masters, the US Open, and then I'll usually pick another challenger. But this year we've upped it. We're going to be a partner of the Chicago Challenger as well as the Charleston Challenger. And I, when I go to these events, Indian Wells is different because that's where all of the players and the brands get together to shoot the content for the rest of the season. Whether it's like with all the new product launches and new rackets, new apparel lines, new bags. And that's where a lot of that stuff is done. So for like this past year, I took a few of my, I got friends that work in tennis and oh, not work in tennis, but work in like film and video and videographers. So we flew out there. Had a couple of my buddies who I've worked with a lot in the past. We filmed about 5 commercials. We had Alicia Parks, Dominic Thiem, Jerry Shang, Layla Fernandez. And then we just did some like, we went to an event called Desert Smash, which is put on by Wilson, where I just did a lot of promo content, which Pink was like the face of that. She, Tiafa was there, Casper Ruud. And we just kind of promoted some of our partners' work as well as us being around the game. And the commercials were fun. We haven't, none of those have aired yet, but just finished editing a couple of those. And then when we're on the grounds, I mean, I try to connect with coaches. I try to get some of them on our Pure Tennis podcast is a podcast I launched. We're like 50 episodes in. So we're not quite up to 73, but we're trying to catch you guys. But I mean, I'll do a podcast on site. I'll do practice content. I will, we'll do a little bit of like, so I just got media credentials. This was the first year where I was credentialed for Indian Wells in Miami. So I did do some of the, just the regular everyday media stuff where you're doing like going to press conferences and trying to get some sound bites. I'm definitely the guy that's asking some of the nerdier. I just want to kind of know why these guys tweak rackets. For example, in Miami, I asked Tommy about him changing. He changed from the Blade to the V-Core. So I like to kind of get some of that information that we can't get unless we're talking to these players ourselves. And I think the canonness, you just don't get that canonness from an email or an Instagram. So you have to kind of go and get it yourself. So we'll do some of that content. And then we just talk to people that are in tennis at these events. So there's a lot, whether it's trying to get an influencer on board with us, trying to get a coach that we can like help sponsor, trying to get another player. So right now we have JJ Wolf and Oscar Adi, part of our team right now. Oscar actually wears our brand called Quiet Please. And then JJ has been an affiliate of ours for the last few years. So we'll try to connect with as many people as we can, create as much as content as we can. And then, yeah, I mean, I'll talk to fans or anybody just to see kind of how we can get into their market. So, yeah. And then the commercials are obviously probably the biggest aspect of those.
So 2 questions. What software do you use to edit your video?
Well, Premiere. I mean, so yeah. I will say I've got 2 guys that I work with on a daily basis that really are a lot better editing than I am. I'm more of the, I'll kind of draw out the concept, write the script, create the shot list. I will kind of dictate like what the players are doing and make sure that we're kind of getting the player to do things that we want to see on camera. And then sure. I kind of go sit in the studio and we'll have like a 7 or 8 hour day where I kind of leave it up to the pros. These guys do edits all day. I mean, they'll do it for commercials sure. and for movies and stuff. So I kind of go, I'll go sit in and I'll kind of say what I want to see and get kind of feedback from what they think. And I like to kind of pick the music out and kind of create the vibe. But when it comes to the editing process, yeah, I'm usually not the one clicking the buttons unless it's like a TikTok or an Instagram.
No, makes sense. And then how much has ChatGPT changed like your script writing as you think about video and getting some ideas? Have you used it any?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, no, for sure. I have, if you want to be efficient and kind of adapt with the times, you got to use the technology that's out there that's given to you. And that's definitely a weapon that makes you feel more dangerous with kind of, it's just a big time resource. So, I mean, I've used it to organize like a task list. I've used it to generate like, if I need help with like a script idea, I'll put in like my script and I'll just ask it to like, add like a different tone and just kind of see what it spits out. And I don't always take what it gives me, but at least it'll trigger another idea or it'll give me another kind of vantage point of what I'm trying to do. So, I mean, then it also helps if you need like a Fun Facts Friday post and you want to say, give me 10 fun facts about Novak Djokovic or whatever it is. I mean, Nick Kyrgios. I mean, so that stuff, it can spit out pretty quickly, which is always helpful. But yeah, I mean, we've got, One of my teammates, his name is Bartosz Wasiuk. He plays for NKU right now. We brought him in as an intern a couple of years ago. And yeah, we're always trying to figure out new ways that ChatGPT can help us. For example, I signed an influencer for Indian Wells, and I'd never written a contract. I mean, I took business law class in college, but they didn't really teach you how to write a social media contract. So I kind of put in the parameters of what I wanted it to contain. And I put the deliverables in there, and then I put the, kind of the dates and stuff and the monetary value. And then I said, like, turn this into a contract that ends, that starts here and ends there. And 2 minutes later, you got a professionally written contract that will pass through and the accountants will accept.
Isn't that awesome? I mean, I've used it for the same purposes. I had about 100-page contract I had to read through last week, and I just pasted each page in and said, summarize this for an idiot, and it gave me out like the best summary, and I would just do one page at a time. So, man, it's definitely made things more efficient.
Oh, it's a big time tool to have. And I remember my boss probably thought I was like this super smart guy that could do a contract. So I'm just like, I'll let her believe that. But I just wrote down what I wanted to include, and then it makes you look like the smart guy in the room. But definitely have no experience talking in that lingo. That was but it was cool to see. My buddy told me to do it. We were at Indian Wells when we were doing it, and I was like, dude, I have no experience writing contracts. I'm like, he's like, dude, just put in ChatGPT. I'm like, damn, you think it can do that? And he was like, yeah. And I put it in there, and I think my jaw dropped. I'm like, no way. In 5 minutes, I've got a contract that this agent is ready to sign. That was pretty cool. I mean, back in the day without ChatGPT, I'm sure that would take like, it probably cost me a solid penny. And then who knows what the turnaround time for that would be. So, I mean, I could have missed out on an influencer opportunity in Indian Wells if I didn't have ChatGPT.
Totally. Yeah. You know, I've also got a YouTube channel, and just like you said, also just letting it spit out ideas. And I think what you said is important. It's kind of like a digital assistant. You don't have to necessarily take its idea. Some of them are good and some are bad, but just the prompting of the ideas are awesome. I think it's interesting how it's changing so many different fields. I know that's off the topic of tennis, but
no, I mean, ideating is so time consuming. It drains your energy. I don't think your boss, if you worked 8 hours and you told her that for 6 of those hours you were just trying to kind of brush up on some ideas that you had and kind of create some visions and kind of script them out, I don't know how cool they would be with that. But I mean, just having that Kickstarter that ChatGPT will kind of help you kind of fan out the ideas a little bit, and it just does it in such a quick way. I mean, that's where I've found it saved me a lot of time and lets me kind of get into the meat and bones of what we want to accomplish, whether it's just like a graphic or a video, or if it's like if I'm trying to kind of add to the tour and I want to help it create my schedule. I mean, it can do it. It's got so many, it can do so much. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I'm sorry we got onto a technology discussion, but the last thing I'll say, I'm going to go retweet it on our Payers and Players Twitter. But there's a guy who took a webcam, and he used the API to tie the webcam to a vision learning model, and then tied that to ChatGPT. And then he would put like a Coke can in front of it, and he'd say, "What is this?" And it would use the vision learning, and it would go scan it and say it's a Diet Coke out loud. And then he tied it to Google so that it would give it voice. So it would say, "This is a Diet Coke." And then he used the API to Google so that when you said, "Well, how many calories does it have?" it would go to Wikipedia and say, "It's a Diet Coke. It has 0 calories." So when you start thinking about the connections of GPT to a webcam, to a vision learning model, to the internet, man, it gets really strong. You know,
pretty soon it's going to start scanning players and tell us how much body fat they have and what their muscle mass is and what their BMI is. We're going to know what Carlos Alcaraz is eating for breakfast.
I go into a junior tennis world. Eventually you're going to be able to buy very cheap webcams and tie the APIs where it can do line calls for you. Right. I know we've got phone apps that'll do that, but you know, nobody wants to put their $1,000 phone up on the tennis fence, and you can. I've tried it.
We need you to go give this technology to the Big Ten committee so that we can watch this Ohio State Michigan match.
That's right. But you think about being able to wire a couple $100 webcams, and then eventually this is going to get very cheap to do line calls.
And it should be. I mean, yeah. So Swing Vision was the first technology that I saw that could really change tennis. I met Mr. Opelka, George Opelka is his name, Riley's dad, at the Barnes Center in San Diego this past fall. And swing vision. I mean, that's a cool technology that lets players just analyze their strokes a lot better. And then, like you just said, like being able to call, like automatically call lines so that we don't, I mean, yeah, I mean, all of us, we, like, it's like, yeah, if there's videos of these kids and they're not going to cheat, but it's like, you don't really want to post videos of tennis players in our world just hooking each other. That's not going to grow the game. So I think automatic lines calling, eliminating some of these refs that are, I mean, let's just say they're not spring chickens out there calling 100 mile an hour balls. I think that would definitely improve our game as well. So, I mean, technology is, I mean, as much as I hated seeing the real line judges go away, and I was just always used to just the challenge system, and I always thought that was pretty cool and good drama. I have definitely become accustomed to it, and I think it has improved just the pace of play. And yeah, it gives more of the player more ease of mind knowing that call was what it was, and it's judged by lasers. So,
yeah, I do agree with you though. I miss the drama of it. I miss the, was that out? Let's challenge it. But I also like what you just said, that now there's no question. You know, can you imagine John McEnroe? I wonder what his popularity and his career would have been if it was all line called. And now he's not yelling, are you serious? Are you kidding? Like, now it's just, it's called and he moves on.
Exactly.
He would still be mad at machines. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I think that part is missed. I mean, like you said, McEnroe and Kyrgios, those guys that definitely invite the environment that is a little hostile. I think that's the part that we miss. But I hope tennis does in other ways. If we're going to tighten up on this aspect, I think tennis needs to loosen itself up in other ways. So I know I took us in another direction, but just to have
no, that's fine, Nate. It actually leads into where I wanted to go next. And that was sort of, I think, what you put out yesterday on Twitter on Tennis Point, where you asked sort of, what would you like to see added to the tennis viewing experience? Maybe you want to go there.
That's definitely, I'm always down to go there. I think you and I, all of us are probably watch a lot of tennis, and it's like, how much has tennis changed since the 90s or the 2000s? Like, I remember I started watching tennis in like 2003, 2004. It's like, I pretty much see, I mean, yeah, the image, the pixels are much better. It's, you know, it's 4K now, but other than the clarity, I just feel like we haven't given fans any more info. At least, I mean, there's a few graphics that have definitely helped, like with like the ball heights and stuff and showing return positions and stuff like that, and how much guys have run in a match and stuff, but it's not enough. And I think for me, like, I have a lot of friends that watch a ton of other sports, and with sports gambling being as big as it is, like, there's just I think you have to give consumers more than what we're giving them right now. So I think for me, one thing that I've always thought would be interesting is, like, yeah, we at least in when the tournaments are played in the U.S. like, you can see the MPH on every serve, which I look at that, even though I know about how fast these guys are serving it, I look at it almost every time. Like, every ace, I look at the speedometer. I want to know how fast that serve was hit, and I want to know if it's a kick serve. How fast are they hitting a kick serve? I think every shot needs to have a speedometer in the corner somewhere, whether it's on the score, like on the little scorecard, or if it's just a little in the right hand corner. But like, yeah, I want to know if Carlos is hitting a 95 mile an hour forehand, but I also want to know how slow that drop shot is being hit. Like, how much pace is he taking off the ball to drop the ball that, like, that softly and kind of throw. I mean, I want to know all those things. And I think seeing that is, I'm not sure if we need to go as far as like the RPMs and stuff, but like, why would every shot, like I know in baseball, it has the pitch and then it has the exit velocity. It's like, that stuff is cool. I think people think that's just interesting. And I think people would appreciate what these players are doing if they can realize, you know, like, yeah, a pitcher can throw a fastball 105 miles an hour, then a changeup 85 miles an hour, but Carlos Alcaraz is hitting 135 mile an hour serve, followed up by a 17 mile an hour drop shot. It's like, I think that would bring more casual fans in. I think that's the first one that I've kind of think there's a need for.
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to see is I think it's real important for viewers to become more knowledgeable about the players behind the scenes. I don't see enough. The Tennis Channel, and Scott and I have talked about this for years. To me, the Tennis Channel is losing a huge opportunity to drive viewership through kind of those behind the scenes documentaries, right? Because think about it. no one knew the people on Duck Dynasty until that show aired. And now it's like a cult thing, right? I mean, there's so many people who love it. I hate to say cult. I shouldn't say something that has a negative connotation, but people love it. I'll be honest with you. My family likes watching those documentaries more than they like actually watching the game. So, for example, the HBO series that goes before the season, every football season, where they pick a team, Hard Knocks. And you watch mm-hmm. that, you get to know the players, you get to root for the players that are getting cut or not getting cut. And then when you go to watch the game, it's like the game's not as entertaining as the behind the scenes, but at least it gets you to watch the game. And to me, I think tennis is missing the piece where fans get to know the players at all levels. I think this should be happening in college. I think this should be happening on the Futures, the Challengers, and the ATP Tour. But what we do in tennis, in my opinion, too much is focus on the top five players on the tour or the top three players on the tour, and everyone else, no one even knows who they are, unless they're like a real tennis junkie. I mean, JJ Wolf is an exciting player with a great past and story, and tennis junkies know him. But if you went to Walmart right now and said, who's JJ Wolf, they'd look at you like you had three heads, right? You ask who LeBron James is, they all know. You ask who a lot of the NBA players are, not just LeBron, he'd be at the top. So I would love to see more YouTube, more long form, more HBO, more TV content that gets us to know the players.
Yeah, so, Scott, so Nate, what do you think?
Go ahead and clip that, we'll put that on TikTok right there, that whole little rant right there. We'll put that on TikTok.
Yeah. Go ahead. I wondered what y'all are doing in that space. What are y'all doing to help us know the players better? Because it helps you if they're buying their equipment from your website, but we know them and they're wearing that shirt. Now there's a better chance I'm buying my equipment from that website as well.
No, what you just said right there is pretty much that's what I'm thinking about every day. Pretty much when I go to my job is like, how can I make tennis more interesting, more fun? And make the casual fan want to turn on their TV or get to know these players. Not for me, it's really not turn on the TV. It's really open up their app to look at their Instagram page or look at their TikTok or whatever it is. So like you just said, I think the behind the scenes moments are what fans love, they feel like they're learning something that is, whether it's more of like a secretive thing, like the Laver Cup, for example, was probably my favorite viewership experience as a fan of my life. Like, I think like it's a bona fide exhibition match. But if you're going to let me listen to Roger Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic and talk to these young guys, Zverev and Tsitsipas and Medvedev, and help them get through a match and give them strategies and give them tendencies of their opponent and kind of help loosen them up. And I mean, that and watching, you know, Kyrgios and Jack Sock and these guys and just having them mic'd up on the court, I think that was like pretty eye opening for me. And I think that was, I mean, those players are. They're playing for an exhibition, but it felt so much more intense. And I think that team atmosphere, as well as being able to hear what they're saying on the bench, added so much to it. So, I mean, for us, I mean, I do a lot of like last year, one of my favorite pieces of content last year was I was on Matteo Berrettini's practice court with him and his coaches for about an hour and a half. And just like filming him playing, him practicing, and then talking to him about, you know, what's he doing in the city and what's he like to do on road trips and kind of what he misses about, you know, being home. And we talked about why he like, just like his, what he's doing with his gear, how he kind of decides on what he wants to change to and all that stuff. And I think doing more of that content with the players, we just did another piece with Katie McNally a week ago, talking about her tweaks and what she's up to. And I think that's one thing I want to take to the college market as well. We want to do, like, I'm going to the NCAA tournament in Orlando in a couple of weeks. And I think that's one of the main things I want to do. I want to do like a Coach's Corner segment where we get coaches to give more of that behind the scenes look, and then talking to these players. I mean, we do the thing called This or That, where we kind of go through 20 questions, which is like a quick hitting thing, and most of it's non-tennis related, where we make players just kind of think on the spot, and it works well with, I mean, all levels and all players. So I'm always open to more ideas, but we're constantly trying to get these players on camera, on screen. Coming from the basketball world, you see these AAU stars that age 13 or 14 years old, and they're so comfortable being on camera because it starts happening to them when they're 12, 13 years old. So by the time they're playing 17, 18 U tournaments, I mean, they just become accustomed to it. And that's why the subculture of basketball is so strong, in my opinion, because the spotlight is put on these kids at such an early age. And it really is to benefit the athlete. I think that sometimes I go to these tournaments, these parents or these coaches are kind of like skeptical of what I'm doing and why I'm asking for court access or asking for their player to do a bag check, for example. It's like, but then once they kind of see how it lives on our page and what the kind of buzz it kind of gathers, and you know, people are like saying, oh, I played that kid at this tournament, or why does he use that, or what's his, like, just all the questions that you get from that, and that we found that to be some of our most fruitful content. And I think sometimes the ball being hit does numbers, but really, I mean, the players talking about their experiences and kind of why they do what they do and kind of the behind the scenes story of a college athlete is stuff that I've always found fascinating. And I've always figured if I find it fascinating, there's got to be other people that are in the same boat.
Well, here's what I would say is if you've ever gone to a futures, the players are normally staying with a host family. And when you go to that future, what do you always see there? You always see the host family watching. And the reason is they developed a relationship with the player while they were at their home, and now they want to go watch them. Mm-hmm. The video content needs to help the fans develop a relationship with the players, and then they'll show up. I mean, that's all there is to it.
All right. So I hear what you guys are saying about, you know, making content that can generate interest in the game. And I think that's sort of what Netflix tried to do with the Breakpoint series, but it didn't seem to really take off. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the series, and then what you thought about, you know, the reaction to it.
Scott, let me ask before he answers, what makes you say you didn't think it took off? Because I had people catching me that work with me who started talking about people that I guarantee you they had no idea who they were before. Like, for example, Kyrios, they were like, man, I didn't know there was this guy Kyrios. He's a little wild, isn't he? And yeah. And I'm like, what do you, and they're like, there's this new episode on Netflix. So yeah. What makes you think it didn't take off?
Well, I think one, just the previous discussion that you guys had didn't refer to it. For one, and it just seemed like there wasn't, I don't know. And maybe I'm out of the loop, or I just didn't get the sense, but it just seemed like, at least in the tennis Twitter community, mm-hmm. there wasn't a big, you know, buzz about it. It wasn't like, oh my God, these episodes are great, and I can't wait for the next one to come out. It was sort of like, and I know that wasn't their target market. So I don't want to make it sound like, you know, it needed to be a lot more, you know, technical and a lot more in depth than it needed to be. I know it was trying to reach, you know, those people that you were talking about that had never heard
the
of
casual
Kyrios.
Fan. Yeah, the casual
anyways,
fan.
But I'm curious, so anyways, I'd like to hear Nate's thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Well, for one, I did not watch the Formula One doc, which everybody's told me right. to watch that, and I'll probably get around to it at some point. So I'm not sure if they showed more off the track content than tennis did off the court, but I think, I mean, did it do well? I have no clue what the numbers were. I will say I've gotten texts from people, like Robert was saying, I've gotten texts from uncles or friends that I know don't watch tennis on a regular basis that did find parts of it enjoyable. I would say that they missed because on some of it as far as not doing enough off the court. I thought like the few off the court moments that they showed and shared with us, I thought they were great. I mean, some of that was probably on the Netflix team, but some of it was also on the players. I mean, I know, for example, Felix did not let the camera crew in his lockers when he lost matches. That was one example that I'd heard from some sources that just like, so some of the players weren't open to it. I think maybe they didn't want it to kind of interfere with their personal life, but I thought like they just didn't do enough off the court. So we really don't know what any of those players do for fun or what they do like on their downtime when, or on the, like on a preparation day, like where are they going to eat? Are they cooking their food? Like, so I feel like we didn't learn a ton about them in that regard. I thought it definitely wasn't for the everyday tennis fan. I mean, that's, they weren't after us. They know that we're already tennis fans. So, I mean, I don't think I learned anything from that documentary. I didn't expect to learn anything from that documentary because that's pretty much the stuff that we see every day. But I also went into it knowing that it wasn't for me. So I did still just find it enjoyable just as far as like, it told the narratives. I think the coolest part for me from that whole show was the Casper Ruud, Rafa Nadal inside the tunnel. That content was stuff that we don't see as everyday fans. They didn't show that before the match. Don't know why they wouldn't show that when the French Open was being played. I thought that just builds the kind of gladiator drama that we want in tennis.
Right.
And I think that's the big miss on the tournaments. So that was pretty cool to see. It was also cool to see the Tony Nadal, Felix dynamic and how And how they went into that match with Rafa, that was very interesting. I thought the Matteo Berrettini and Ila Tomljanovic in the hotel type content was super eye-opening to see like how superstitious these players are and how picky they are with their schedules. And, you know, he didn't want her to wake him up and like at a certain time. So I think that stuff was cool, but they could have gone another step further. I know there's definitely more to come. So we'll see if they did anything to kind of further that storyline. But I mean, I just don't know if like even a casual fan is going to kind of be able to keep in touch with like what tournament they're going to and when they're so like you got to kind of tell the off, and that's why I probably want to I need to watch the Formula One thing because just to see what they did off the track to see if they were able to get these athletes to more kind of open up more. But I definitely love that tennis got the chance to get that spotlight. I don't it definitely helped in some capacity. I don't know if it helped as much as I thought it would, but I was obviously very optimistic just hearing all these people that didn't watch Formula One before and now they're all like every Sunday they're tuned in. I mean, I've got a lot of that never watched this stuff. And it's like now every Sunday, like they're texting our group chat about some race. And I never have got into it. I feel like I don't have time for anything but tennis, but it's like, at least Formula One must've crushed it. I don't know. Maybe I feel like is tennis more niche? I don't know, but it's like, I feel like there's so many good storylines in tennis and there's so much good drama. It's just not put out there enough at any level. I think whether it's college or pro.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Well, I was gonna say, and I think that there is a lot of drama but we try and hide the drama, you know. So it's if there is beef between two players, that sort of isn't, you know, downplayed. I mean, it's like that should be more highlighted because it is interesting, you know, how Medvedev and Tsitsipas sort of take shots at each other and things like that. Those kind of things are make it interesting. So like, you know, back in the day, you know, when McEnroe was acting, you know, the way he was with Connors. Everyone was interested in those matches because you never knew what was going to happen with those guys. And so if we can, you know, at least build on the drama, build on some of the tension between the players, it makes the match a little bit more interesting.
I mean, 100%, totally agree. Like how do we not want to let the drama hype our sport to another level? It's like, I've come from like the best match I watched all year last year. I mean, not even talking about the level of tennis, just as far as the drama, and that drama is what is going to make that match the most memorable for me. Nick Kyrgios versus Stefanos Tsitsipas at Wimbledon. I mean, that match, I was in the airport and I had probably 20 people like coming by. I had my iPad set up and I had people like all behind this couch watching my screen with me. It's like, I don't know if that'll ever happen again where people were just like, they checked Twitter or they checked Instagram and they saw that there was a lot of stuff going on because ESPN, he was even tweeting about it. And then it also, these people that it didn't seem like many of them even knew who these guys were interested in seeing this drama because they were trying to hit each other. They're talking to each other, talking to the fans. And it's like, that's what we need our sport to be about. That's like, we can't just like, yeah, we're a gentleman's game, but it's like in 2023, when you have to get the younger demographic involved and be an active fan in your sport, you gotta welcome this type of drama. It's like, if you watching the NBA playoffs, it's like, the Jimmy Butler constant trash talk, and I'm a big Jimmy Butler fan. He loves tennis, which makes it even cooler for me because it was a guy I saw at the Miami Open, and a guy that flew down to Argentina to watch Carlos Alcaraz during the All Star break for the NBA. Which I mean, it's like we got to invite those players. You got to tell the story of these players connecting with athletes of other sports, and Jimmy's talking trash all playoff series long. It's like ESPN puts it on every post. They put up what the quotes are, and they put up the video. I think tennis would live in mainstream media more often if they highlighted these things. And it's like the players are going to gain so much more popularity, and they're going to make millions of more dollars in endorsements if they're able to grow their personal brands. I mean, not every player is going to want that drama. I mean, you're never going to have Rafa's never going to be talking crap, but it's like not everybody can be a 23-time Grand Slam champion and a top five player for two decades. So it's like some of these players have to rely on the endorsement money and building their personal brands on social media in the digital space. And the way you can do that is if you're not winning every tournament, you got to be able to build those personas.
Well, and I'm proud Scott brought up what he brought up. You know, Scott, it's a great point. You brought up the Netflix series. I think that's a good start. I just don't, I think that's all it is it's a start. Yep. And there's a whole lot more out there, especially when you get in the Future Challenger Tour, because
you know how it is. We go sit and watch a future challenger. There's like four people at the match. And
we're going to change it.
And that's serious. I mean, like, and sometimes it's just the coach. There's one person. And so I think you get people to know the folks in futures and challengers, and then they want to go watch those matches. They also have tremendous access. I mean, literally, if a fan wants a picture, that's easy because there's like three people there. So it's easy to get a picture with the fan after the match. The other part is you mentioned the drama, and I think that's important. Tennis is such a we got to behave sport, and it starts in the juniors, and I get we want kids to behave. There's no doubt about it. But we kind of get into this. You watch
it is
two
sports,
people,
though. It's sports.
Right. And it's competitive. You get two people chirping at each other in tennis, and what do the announcers often say? Well, the behavior is poor. You get two people chirping in basketball, and it's exciting. And so we've got to also change our mentality. When they're chirping and trash talking, we don't need to turn that into they're a bad person, right? It's just part of sports.
Exactly. I mean, it's like I'm going to start live streaming some of these marketing meetings and show that there's more drama sometimes that happens in these marketing meetings than on the court. It's like,
yes.
Sports are supposed to be more drama. It's the purpose is entertainment. So it's like sometimes I feel like I walk out of these Monday marketing meetings and I'm like, how is there more drama in this meeting when we're just brainstorming than there is in Madrid right now? It's like, so I think that's the issue, is people are trying to make tennis. When I say people, I mean, I don't know who I'm exactly pointing the finger at, but it's like, I think like the ATP is just in the WTA, they try to protect what their piece of the pie is so hard that they've really not allowed the sport to breathe very well, in my opinion. So
sterilized. They have sterilized it.
That's a better way to put it. And that's a personal opinion. And we are partners with the ATP, and we do a lot of great stuff with each other, but I've definitely made a push to do more of that storytelling and to be more open to content sharing. And there's just so many rights and things loops that we have to jump through to just get simple stuff done. And I think that's the problem, is like, sometimes we create it, like just to create one simple piece of content. Like I had talked to 12 different people just to get signed off. And it's just like, when I working in basketball for a couple of years, that was like never an issue. It was just like, you have an idea, go shoot it. The players, like, they're going to put it on their store. It's like, it was so much more fluid.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. So I do have to ask though, you mentioned earlier that you guys, Tennis Point has its own brand, Quiet Please. Is that right?
Correct.
So what we're just talking about is tennis is too quiet and tennis is too, you know, to tone it down. So what was the thought behind the brand Quiet Please with a monkey, you know, putting his finger up to say, shh.
What a good question, man. Scott coming in with a good question right there.
Scott did his homework for this one.
I love the brand. I love the clothes. They look cool. I like the monkey with the, you know, the logo, and it's cool. But it just got me thinking, you know, we're just talking about how we want, you know, more noise. We want more, you know, more flair. And then your brand is Quiet Please. So come on.
That was definitely intentional. I wasn't okay. I was not in any of those meetings personally, but I know that was done intentionally. It's kind of a
ironic. It's ironic. Yeah.
It could be a little elbow in the rib.
I love it.
So that was definitely, there was some thought put behind that, and it's, you hear Quiet Please, all these chair umpires always saying in their native language, you know, Quiet Please for the fans. And it's like, I think Tennis Point has had a large focus the last few years. I mean, it's been probably the sole focus to grow the game of tennis. And that we constantly look at the numbers of households playing and how many rackets were purchased by different households and all these numbers that we look at. And it's like, we want tennis to be a little more rambunctious. I think we want people to be able to express themselves. And all of us have been to good college matches. You're never going to hear a ref say quiet down or keep it down. And those are the best environments, the best atmospheres to play, the best atmospheres to observe. I think the NCAA tournament, if you guys if there's fans listening that haven't been to a college match, you gotta go to one, because you won't look at tennis the same way as you do. And it's like, once we become open with, like, yeah, if one fan is just screaming every point and everybody else is quiet, it does sound and the optics aren't great. But it's like, you gotta let everybody clap and like Tommy Paul was saying when I interviewed him in Miami, it's like, let fans drink beer, get rowdy, and just enjoy the game. It's like they, most of these players, at least in my experience, want, like they if it's going to be universally accepted, they're totally cool with it happening. Like they just don't, it's just weird if only one fan is acting up and the rest of the people are quiet. Then it's, then it becomes a distraction when you're tossing the ball and just one person's yelling. But if you got to let fans change, like move seats and can like it just becomes, if you ever take somebody that hasn't been to a tennis tournament and you go with them and you take them to a Masters 1000, and it's just going to be a weird experience from them going from other sports to like kind of being told to sit down and be quiet. And yeah, you can
100%.
you can have a beverage, but don't get too excited when this guy wins a point. And like, if this guy has an unforced error, don't clap. That's rude. It's like, well then it gets a little crazy.
Well, let me, there's two golf tournaments that are really the most popular golf tournaments in the world. Obviously the Masters. And the other one is going to be the tournament at Scottsdale in Arizona, where they basically put a stadium around a par three. And when the golfers hit a bad shot, everyone boos. And when they hit a hole in one, they literally throw beer onto the course. Right. I mean, it is so freaking fun. And if you ask anybody, what are the two golf tournaments you want to go to? Those are the two they're going to tell you. The Masters for the history, the Scottsdale for the fun. Right. And so to your point, it's got to be more. I mean, you, what a great point you said. I've taken people who know nothing about tennis to a tennis match, and then you'll be standing on the rail to go back to your seat, and they'll make you wait till a changeover. And you take somebody who knows nothing about tennis, and they're like, why are we just standing here? Well, you got to be quiet during the points. And they're like, what? You know, in a baseball game, they're screaming, everything else, they're screaming and hollering. To your point, we've got to make it more fun.
And it's, I mean, if tennis didn't open their eyes, it's like, I had so many friends messaging me, the guy that hit the hole in one, I think it was a LIV tournament, but it's like when they all chuck beer and stuff on the course, and he's like, the celebration was like, it was insane. And they played loud rap music and stuff. And it's like,
yes,
those videos taken by fans, not even taken with a $30,000 camera, just iPhone footage. They were doing millions of views, millions. And that grows your game. So like, it's just organic reach, and it's just the easiest way to grow your game is to let fans do it for you. But if you don't ever give fans a spectacle or the environment or the atmosphere like that sports are supposed to have, it's just like you're asking the player to just hit unbelievable, miraculous, like heroic shots to go viral on social. And that's just like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Right. Man, what a great conversation, Scott. Yeah. This is awesome. Yeah. I mean, guys, this is a blast.
We got to do it again, Nate. I know you got to run. So we'll wrap it up there, but we will definitely do this again. I got so much more left on my agenda to get to with you. So we'll definitely pick it up here soon. But for now, we will let you go.
Scott and Robert, I really appreciate you guys having me on. I've been a big fan of Pairs and Players, and it's awesome to see other people and other tennis players kind of they're gonna gravitate towards who's promoting the game. And you guys do a tremendous job of it. So tennis point, you guys ever need anything tennis related, let me know. And have a great rest of the weekend, and happy Sunday, guys. Appreciate you guys for having me.